16, Ilium by Dan Simmons, continuing on page 493. "Why not?" said Harmon, but then he nodded. "Caliban." "Yes," said Prospero. "Even my erstwhile goblin would grind his joints with dry convulsions and shorten up his sinews with aged cramps should he try hard vacuum without a suit of thermskin. But he forgot and bit through poor Savvy's." "There were two more suits he could have had the last month," said Demon, his voice so low it fell below the whisper of ventilation. The room left the curved slice of earth above and rotated into starlight. There was a half-moon rising above Prospero. "And he would have, but Caliban is no god," said the Magus. "Savvy did not kill the beast with her full salvo of flechettes to its chest, but she hurt it sore. Caliban has been bleeding and recovering, gone deep sometimes to his deepest grotto, where he packs the wounds with mud muck and drinks lizard blood for strength."
"We've been drinking and eating the same," said Demon.
"Yes," said Prospero, showing an old man's yellow smile, "but you don't enjoy it." "How do we get to the Sony?" asked Harmon. "And do you have food in here?"
"No to your second question," said Prospero. "No one but Caliban has eaten here on this stony isle for the last 500 years. But yes to your first. There is a membrane on the tower glass high up that will let you pass out to the launch terrace. Your suits may protect you long enough to charge up the Sony and activate its guidance program. Do you remember how to fly the thing?"
"I think I watched Savvy. I mean," stammered Harmon. He shook his head as if brushing away cobwebs. His eyes looked as weary as Demon felt.
"We'll have to. We will.
You'll have to pass the Fermory and Caliban again to reach the far tower," said Prospero. The old man's little eyes moved from Harmon to Demon, and the gaze was judicial. "Do you have anything else you must do before you flee this place?"
"No," said Harmon.
"Yes," said Demon. He managed to stand and stagger over to the curved window wall. The reflection there was thin, gaunt and bearded, but there was something new in its eyes. "We have to destroy the Fermory," he said. "We have to destroy this whole damned place." 52. Ilium and Olympus. "For some reason, I flee with the Trojans on Thicket Ridge toward and through the smaller man-gates of the Scaean Gates, main entrance to Ilium. The wind still howls, and we're all partially deaf from the nuclear explosion to the south. My last glimpse of the mushroom cloud before entering the city with the shoving mob of Trojan soldiers shows me that the column of smoke and ash is already beginning to bend southeast with the prevailing wind. There's still a hint of Zeus's face in the coiled cloud at the top, but the wind and the cloud's own enfolding is breaking up that visage as well. Scores are crushed at the man gates, so Hector orders the guards to throw wide the central Scaean gates, something that hasn't been done for more than 9 years. The thousands flock inside. The Argives have run for their ships, just as Hector is trying to rally his panicked troops here. I catch a glimpse of Achilles trying to hold back the fleeing Greeks. In the Iliad, in Achilles' rampage after Patroclus' death, Homer tells of the man-god fighting a flooding river and winning, damming it with the bodies of his Trojan enemies. But now Achilles can't stop this tsunami of fleeing Achaeans without killing hundreds, and this he will not do. I'm swept into the city, already sorry that I ran. I realized that I should have fought my way through the milling mob on the ridge to where I saw the little robot Monmouth, sheltering behind the boulders atop the Amazon Marina's mounded tomb. Does the robot, what did he call his type, Moravec? Does the Moravec know that Zeus's weapon was nuclear, possibly thermonuclear? Suddenly, a memory emerges from my other life, as so many have in the past week or so. Susan trying to drag me to a talk at IU Science Hall during some multidisciplinary week at the university. A scientist named Moravec was speaking about his autonomous artificial intelligence theories. Fritz, Hans, I hadn't gone, of course, of what interest would some scientist's theories be to a classical scholar. Well, it doesn't matter now. As if to underline this point, five chariots appear from the north. I know the QT point they translated in through up there. And begin circling the city at an altitude of 3,000 or 4,000 feet. Even with optical amplification, I can't make out the little figures and the gleaming machines, but it looks as if there are both gods and goddesses up there. Then the bombardment begins. The shafts scream down into the city like slender, silver ballistic missiles. And where each one strikes, there is an explosion, dust and smoke rising, screams. Ilium is a large city by ancient standards, but the arrows come fast, from Apollo's bow, I realize, although I think I can make out Ares doing the shooting when the chariot swoops low to assess the damage. And soon the explosions and screams are coming from every quarter of the walled metropolis. I realize that I've not only lost control of everything, I've lost sight of everyone I should be talking to, helping, conferring with. Achilles is probably 3 miles away down the hill already, back with his men, trying to keep them from sailing away in panic. Hearing more explosions, conventional, not nuclear, coming from the Achaean camp, see how Achilles can succeed his men. A sight of Hector, and see that the huge Achaean had been swung shut again, as if that can keep out the gods. For Monmouth and his silent pal Orfu are probably destroyed out there on the ridge already. I don't see how anything can survive this bombardment. More explosions from the central marketplace. Red-crested soldiers rush to reinforce the walls, but the danger is not outside the walls. The golden chariot swings above again, outside of even archer shot, and five silver arrows rain down like scud missiles, exploding near the south wall, near the central well, and apparently right on Priam's palace. This is beginning to remind me of CNN images from the second war with Iraq, right before I became ill with cancer. Hector. The hero is probably rallying his men, but since there's nothing to rally them for except to duck and cover, it's possible that Hector has gone to his home to check on Andromache. I think of that empty, blood-stained nursery, and grimace even here in the smoke and noise of the bombed city street. The royal couple hasn't had time to bury their baby yet. Jesus God, is all this my doing? A flying chariot swoops low. An explosion breaches the ramparts along the main wall and throws a dozen red-caped figures into the air. Body parts rain into the streets and patter on rooftops like fleshy hail. Suddenly another memory returns, a similar horror 3,200 years in this world's future. 2,001 bloody years after the birth of Christ. In my mind's eye, I see bodies hurling down into the street and a wall of dust and pumice chasing the fleeing thousands. Just as I see down Ilium's main street this moment, only the buildings and modes of dress are different. We'll never learn. Things will never change. I run for Hector's home. More missiles rain down, blasting the plaza just inside the gate from where I've just come. I see a small child staggering into the street from rubble that was a two-story home just minutes before. I can't tell if the toddler is a little boy or girl, but the child's face is bloody, its curly hair covered with plaster dust. I stop running and go to one knee to gather the child in. Where can I take it? There's no hospital in Ilium. But a woman with a red scarf over her head runs to the infant and scoops it up. I wipe rivulets of sweat out of my eyes and stagger on toward Hector's house. It's gone. The whole of Hector's palace is missing, just rubble and a series of holes in the ground. I have to keep mopping sweat out of my eyes to see, and even when I see, I can't believe. This whole block has been pounded by the missiles raining down. Already Trojan soldiers are digging through the rubble with their spears and makeshift shovels. Their proud red crests turned gray by the dust in the air. They create a human chain to hand bodies and body parts back to the waiting crowds in the street. "Hakenberry," says a voice.
I realize that someone's been saying my name over and over, but now has begun tugging at my arm. Hakenberry. I turn stupidly, blink away sweat again, and look down at Helen. She's dirty. Her gown is bloodied and her hair is unkempt. I've never seen anyone or anything so beautiful. She hugs me, and I gather her in with both arms. She pulls apart. Are you badly hurt, Hakenberry? What? Are your injuries severe? I'm not hurt, I say. She touches my face then, and her hand comes away red with blood. I raise my hand to my temple, a deep cut there, another in my hairline. See the bloody fingers on both of my hands, and realize that I've been wiping blood away, not sweat. I'm fine, I say. I point to the smoking rubble. Hector? Andromache? They weren't there, Hakenberry, Helen shouts over the screams and babble. Hector sent his family to Athena's temple. The basement is safe there.
I look through the smoke and see the tall roof of the temple standing. Of course, I think. The gods aren't going to bomb their own temples, too much fucking ego.
Theano is dead, says Helen, and Hecuba, and Laodice.
I repeat the name stupidly. Athena's priestess, the woman with the cold blade at my balls just hours ago, and Priam's wife and daughter. Three of my Trojan women dead already, and the bombardment's just begun. Suddenly I whirl around in panic. The noise is wrong. The blasts have stopped. Men and women in the streets are pointing skyward and shouting. Four of the five chariots have already disappeared, and now the fifth. Ares' bombardment chariot, I think, flies north and winks out of existence, obviously QTing back to Olympus. All this damage. I look around at the tumbled buildings, smoking craters, bloodied bodies in the streets. From just one god's attack with one bow and a few of Apollo's arrows, what next? Biological attack? The Shining Archer, probably recovering up there in the healing tanks right now, is famous for firing plague into the people below. I grab the medallion at my neck. Where's Hector? I ask Helen. I have to find Hector. He went back out through the Scaean Gate with Paris, Aeneas, and his brother Deiphobus, says Helen. He said he has to find Achilles before All Hearts flag. I have to find him, I repeat. I turn toward the main gate, but Helen pulls me back and around. Hakenberry, she says, and pulls my face down to hers and kisses me there in the shoving, screaming street. When her lips leave mine, I can only blink stupidly, still bent to her kiss. Hakenberry, she says again, if you must die, die well. Then she turns and strides back up the street without once looking back. 53. The Equatorial Ring. Damon was only a little surprised to see that the Prospero hologram can stand and walk. The Magus picked up his staff and walked slowly to the dome window of the room. When he lifted his face to watch the stars march by, the pale light emphasized the wrinkles on his throat and cheeks. All this onslaught of old age in recent days made Damon queasy, and even queasier considering what they're discussing at that moment. He tried to imagine a world in which his friends and he, his mother, grew old like Savi, like this mottled and wattled hologram. The horror of it made him shudder. Then he remembered the horror of the tanks, the blue worms, and Caliban's dining table. Wouldn't it be easier just to kill the monster, leave the infirmary intact? No, Damon realized through his hunger and fatigue. This place was an obscenity any way one looked at it. The entire belief system of the 520s was based on the conviction that people went to the rings after 100 years, joining the post-humans up here in comfort and immortality. Damon thought of the gray, half-eaten corpses floating out there in the thin, stale air, and could only snort a laugh.
What is it? Asked Prospero, half-turning from the view.
Nothing, said Damon. He felt like weeping or breaking something, preferably the latter.
How can we destroy the infirmary? Asked Harmon. The taller, older man was shivering from his illness. His face was even paler than Demon's and sheened slick with sweat.
How indeed? Asked Prospero.
He leaned on his staff and looked at them.
Did you bring explosives, weapons, other than Savi's silly little pistol or tools?
No, said Harmon. There are none up here, said Prospero. The post-humans had evolved themselves far beyond wars and conflicts, or tools.
The servitors did all work up here.
They're still working, said Demon. Only in the infirmary, said the Magus. They crossed slowly back to the center console. Have you given thought to the hundreds of human beings floating helpless in the infirmary tanks? My God, whispered Harmon. Demon rubbed his cheek, feeling the beard there. It was an oddly satisfying sensation. We can't use the fax nodes in the healing tanks to get back to Earth, he said. But presumably those people already in the tanks could be faxed back to the portals from which they came.
Yes, said Prospero, if you can convince the servitors to do so, or if you were to take over the fax controls yourselves. But there's a problem with that.
What? Said Demon. But even as he asked the question, he saw the problem clearly.
Prospero smiled grimly and nodded. For those who've just been faxed up to the tanks, or those finished with their blue worm healing process, fax return is possible. But for those hundreds midway in the healing process... His silence said everything.
What can we do? Asked Harmon. There will be new people faxing in and healed ones faxing out, hundreds in the process. If Prospero's right and we can take over the fax controls, said Demon, we could shut off the incoming, then continue to fax down the healed as the process is finished, until all the tanks are empty. We've both been in the tanks. How long does the 20 healing usually take? 24 hours? 48 for serious injuries like being eaten by an Allosaurus?
You weren't being healed for that, said Prospero. They were rebuilding you from scratch, using your updated memory codes from the fax grid banks, stored DNA and organic spare parts. But you are correct. Even the slowest healing cases require no more than 48 hours.
Demon opened his hands and looked at Harmon. 2 days from the time we take over the infirmary.
If we can take over the infirmary and control the fax process, Harmon said doubtfully.
The Magus leaned on the back of his chair.
I can do nothing, but I can give information, said the old man. I can tell you how the fax controls work.
But we won't be able to fax down ourselves? Harmon asked again. Obviously, the thought of using the Sony worried him.
No, said Prospero.
Can we reprogram the servitors to handle the faxing? Asked Demon.
No, said the Magus. You will have to destroy or disable them, but they are not programmed for conflict.
Neither are we, laughed Harmon. Prospero stepped around his chair. Yes, he whispered.
You are. With human beings, no matter how civilized you may appear, it is just a matter of reawakening old programming.
Demon and Harmon looked at one another. Harmon shivered again in his blue thermskin suit.
Your genes remember how to kill, said Prospero. Come, let me show you the instrument of destruction.
Prospero's hologram couldn't manipulate the virtual controls in the center console himself. But he showed Demon and Harmon how to use their hands on and in the complex glowing toggles, shunts, slides, switches, and manipulators. An image misted into solidity above the console, then rotated in three dimensions for their inspection. It's one of those big E-ring devices we saw on the way in, said Demon.
A linear accelerator with its wormhole collection ring, said Prospero. The post-humans were so proud of these things. As you saw, they made thousands.
So, said Harmon, are you saying that the fax system on Earth is controlled by these things?
Prospero shook his brow heavy head. Your fax system is terrestrial. It doesn't move bodies through space and time, only data. But these wormhole collectors are the spiders in the center of the post-humans' quantum teleportation web.
So, said Harmon again, we just want to go back to Earth.
Grip that green controller and squeeze the red circle twice, said Prospero.
Demon did so. On the holographic display of the orbital linear accelerator, a small quad of engine thrusters pulsed twice, sending a tiny silver cone of crystallized exhaust into space. The long array of girders, tanks, columns, and rings began to rotate ever so slowly. Counter thrusters fired just as briefly, and the long accelerator stabilized. The 50-meter-wide shimmering wormhole at its end, centered within the huge and gleaming collection ring, had not turned with the accelerator. Demon leaned close to the holographic image of the accelerator and saw that the collection ring was on gimbals. He reached a finger into the image, touched different elements, and saw the vid image shift into diagrams and descriptive lettering. Return line, injector, quad thrusters. He removed his hand and the real-time image reappeared. The words had, of course, meant nothing to him.
Attitude control, orbital translation thrusters, said Prospero. This asteroid is in stable orbit. It would be a possible species extinction event if it fell onto the Earth. But the wormhole collecting accelerators and the Casimir mirrors were constantly being moved around.
From here? Said Demon.
Prospero nodded. And from the other asteroid cities?
Harmon and Demon looked at each other again. There are more post-human cities? Asked Harmon.
Three more, said the Magus. One other on this equatorial ring, two on the polar ring.
Are there living post-humans there? Asked Demon. He suddenly saw an alternative to all this destruction and the end of the 520s way of life.
No, Prospero sat in his high-backed chair. And there are no other firmaries either. This city was the only one that bothered itself with the affairs of you modified old styles down there.
He waved a mottled hand toward the earth rising on the right curve of the dome. The room was suddenly brightened again by earthlight. All the posts are dead, repeated Demon.
No, not dead, said Prospero, gone elsewhere.
Demon looked at the limb of the earth rising in the blackness of space above the shimmering curve of atmosphere. Gone where?
Mars, to begin with, said the Magus. He looked at their quizzical expressions and chuckled. Do either of you modern men have any idea where Mars is? What Mars is?
No, said Demon without embarrassment. Will the posts be coming back from there?
I think not, said Prospero, still smiling.
Then it doesn't matter, does it? Said Harmon. Prospero, were you suggesting we could use this particle accelerator wormhole thing as a weapon?
As the ultimate weapon against this city, said Prospero.
Common explosives or weapons would have little effect on the crystal city or its asteroid. These towers are made to withstand actual meteor impact.
But 3 kilometers and more of heavy mass exotic materials with a wormhole on its snout, under thrust, will have a definite impact, especially if you target it directly on the firmary.
Will Caliban survive? Asked Demon.
Prospero shrugged. His tunnels and grottos have saved him before, but perhaps such a collision will provide a Caliban species extinction event here of its own.
Can he escape before it hits? Asked Harmon.
Only if he learns of the Sony and takes possession of one of your thermskin suits, said Prospero.
And he smiled disconcertingly, as if such a prospect was not totally improbable. How long will it take for this accelerator monstrosity to get here? Asked Demon. Until impact.
You can program it to arrive as quickly or slowly as you wish, said the Magus, rising and walking into the center console, his lower body disappearing into the metal and virtual panels.
He raised one arm, the robe slid back a bit, and the skinny forearm and bony finger pointed to the end of the accelerator away from the wormhole ring.
Right here, said Prospero. Are the plane change thrusters, the most powerful engines. I'll show you how to activate them and to aim this weapon.
The two followed his instructions on rotating the accelerator and programming what Prospero called its trajectory coordinates and delta V. Demon's finger hovered above the initiate virtual button. You didn't tell us how long we have until impact, he said to Prospero.
The hologram steepled its fingers. 50 hours sounds right. An hour for you to get to the firmary and take control. 48 hours to allow the new arrivals to heal and to fax them all back intact. An hour, then, to find your way to the Sony and escape before this little world ends.
No time to sleep, said Harmon.
I would advise against it, said Prospero. Caliban will probably be trying to kill you every minute of that time.
Harmon and Demon exchanged glances. We can take turns napping and eating and keeping watch at the controls there, said Demon. He hefted the pistol and then set it back in Savi's pack. We'll keep Caliban at bay. Harmon nodded doubtfully. He looked very, very weary. Demon looked at the real-time image of the linear accelerator again and set his thumb above the thruster initiate button again.
Prospero, you're sure this won't end all life on Earth or anything?
The Magus chuckled.
All life as you know it, yes, he said. But no flaming asteroid from the sky species extinction event. At least I don't believe so. We'll have to see.
Demon looked at Harmon, whose own hands were wrist-deep in the virtual panel.
Do it, said Harmon.
Demon pushed the button. On the display above the holographic projector, 8 huge thrusters at the end of the linear accelerator lit up with solid, continuous pulses of blue ion ignition. The long structure shuddered slightly and began to move slowly, directly toward Demon's and Harmon's faces. Goodbye, Prospero, said Demon, grabbing Savi's pack and turning toward the semi-permeable exit.
Who knows, said Prospero. If you make it to the firmary, I'll be there. I wouldn't miss the next 50 hours for the world.
54. The Plains of Ilium and Olympus. I leave the burning city in search of Achilles and see chaos stretching all the way to the sea. Trojans and Achaeans alike are pulling bodies from smoking craters from the sea and gates to the surf's edge, and everywhere confused men are helping their wounded comrades back to Ilium or across the defensive trench into the Greek camps. As with most aerial bombardments in my era, the effects of the attack were more terrifying than the results. I imagine that there are several hundred dead, but most escaped unharmed, especially out here away from falling walls and flying masonry. As I'm clambering over the lowest part of Thicket Ridge, I see the little robot coming toward me, tugging along his floating crab-shell friend, like a little boy pulling in a specially large radio flyer wagon. For some reason, I'm so pleased to see them alive, although still in existence might be a better term, that I come very close to crying. Harkenberry, says the robot Monmouth, you're injured, is it bad? I touch my forehead and scalp. The bleeding has almost stopped. It's nothing. Harkenberry, do you know what that large blast was? Nuclear explosion, I say. It could have been thermonuclear, but for all its roar, I suspect it was just a fission weapon. A little larger than the Hiroshima bomb, perhaps. I don't know much about bombs. Monmouth cocks his head at me. Where are you from, Harkenberry?
Indiana, I reply without thinking.
Monmouth waits. I'm a Skolic, I say to him again, knowing that he's passing all this along to his silent friend via the radio link he called Tight Beam earlier. The gods rebuilt me out of old bones and DNA and some sort of memory fragments they extracted from the bits they found on Earth.
Memory from DNA? Said Monmouth. I don't think so.
I wave my hands impatiently. It doesn't matter, I snap. I'm the Walking Dead. I lived in the second half of the 20th century. Probably died in the first part of the 21st. I'm hazy on dates. I was hazy on everything in my past life until recent weeks when memories started flooding back. I shake my head. I'm a dead man walking. Monmouth continues looking at me with that dark metallic strip instead of eyes. Then he nods judiciously and kicks me, rather viciously, in the left shin. God damn it, I cry, hopping on the other leg. Why'd you do that?
You seem alive to me, says the little robot.
How did you come here from the 20th or 21st lost age century, Harkenberry? Most of our Moravec scientists are fairly sure that such time travel is impossible unless you're whipping around near the speed of light or swimming too close to a black hole. Did you do either of those things?
I don't know, I say. And surely it doesn't matter. Look at all this.
I gesture toward the smoking city and the chaos on the plains of Ilium. Already some of the Greek ships are putting to sea.
Monmouth nods. For a robot, his body language is oddly human.
Morfu wonders why the gods broke off their attack, he says. I glance at the huge battered shell of a thing behind him. Sometimes I forget that there's reportedly a brain in there.
Tell Orfu that I don't know, I say. Perhaps they just want to enjoy the fear and chaos down here for a while before administering the coup de grace. I hesitate a second. That's French for Ibea. Yes, I know French, unfortunately, says Monmouth. Orfu was just quoting some fairly irrelevant truths to me in French during the bombardment. What are you going to do next, Tockenberry? I look toward the Achaean encampment. Tents are burning, wounded horses are running in panic, men are milling, ships are being outfitted for sea. Others already are moving out, away from the coast, their sails catching the wind. I was going to find Achilles and Hector, I say, but it may take me hours in all this mess. In 18 minutes and 35 seconds, says Monmouth, something is going to happen that may change everything. I look at him and wait. I planted a device up there in the Caldera Lake, says the little robot. Orfu and I brought it all the way from Jupiter space. Putting that thing up there was the main goal of our mission, actually, although we weren't supposed to be the ones delivering it to... Well, that's another story. At any rate, in 17 minutes, 52 seconds, the device triggers itself. It's a bomb, I say hoarsely.
Suddenly my mouth is absolutely dry. I couldn't spit if my life depended on it.
Monmouth shrugs in that oddly human way of his. We don't know.
You don't know? I bellow. You don't know? How could you plant a device up there and set a timer if you don't know what it's going to do? That's ridiculous.
Perhaps, says Monmouth, but it's what we were sent here to do. Well, sent there, actually, by the Moraveks who planned this mission. How long did you say? I ask, grabbing the apparent leather bracelet on my wrist that serves as my own covert chronometer. The bracelet has microcircuits and small holographic projectors for when I need to know the time. 17 minutes and 8 seconds, says the little robot. I'm counting. I set the timer on my watch and leave the little holographic display visible. Shit, I say. Yes, agrees Monmouth. Are you QTing back up there, Hockenberry, to Olympus? I'd set my hand on the QT medallion at my throat, but only because I was thinking about saving a few minutes by teleporting straight into the Achaean camp to find Achilles. But Monmouth's question makes me pause and think. Maybe I should, I say. Someone needs to see what the gods are up to. Perhaps I could play spy one last time. And then what? Asks the robot. It's my turn to shrug. Then I come back for Achilles and Hector. Then maybe, say, Odysseus and Paris, Aeneas and Diomedes, carry the war to the gods, shuttling these heroes up there two by two like animals on Noah's Ark. That doesn't sound too efficient as military campaign logistics go, says Monmouth. Do you know military strategy, little robot person? No, actually. All I really know anything about is a submersible that sank on Mars and Shakespeare's sonnets, says Monmouth. He pauses. Orfu just told me that I shouldn't include the sonnets in my resume. Mars, I say. The shiny metallic head turns up toward me. You didn't know that Olympus is really the volcano Olympus Mons on Mars? You've lived there for 9 Earth years, haven't you? For a second I'm dizzy enough that I have to stagger over to a low boulder and sit, or I'm afraid I'll wake up on the ground. Mars, I repeat. 2 moons, the huge volcano, the red soil, the reduced gravity that I was always so happy to return to after a long day on the plains of Ilium. Mars. Fuck me, Mars. Monmouth says nothing, perhaps knowing that he's embarrassed me enough for one day. Wait a minute, I say. Mars doesn't have blue skies, oceans, trees, air to breathe. I watched the first Viking lander touch down in 1976. I watched on TV years later. Decades later, when that little sojourner buggy thing trundled down and got stuck on a rock. There were no oceans, no trees, no air. They've terraformed it, says Monmouth, and rather recently, too. Who's terraformed it, I say, hearing the defensive anger in my voice. The gods, says Monmouth, but I can hear the slight hint of a question mark in his smooth robot voice. I look at my watch, 15 minutes, 38 seconds. I tap the virtual chronometer display in front of the little robot's cameras or eyes or whatever's behind that sunglass strip on his face. What's going to happen in 15 minutes, Monmouth? Don't tell me you and Orfu don't know. We don't know, says Monmouth. I'm going up there to see what's going on, I say, grabbing the medallion. Take me, says Monmouth. I set the timer. I should be there when the device activates. I pause again, looking at the huge shell behind Monmouth. Are you going to defuse it? I asked. No, that was my mission, to deliver and activate the device. But if the timer doesn't trigger it, I should be there in person to set it off. Are we talking, even as a low-priority probability, the end of the world here, Monmouth? The robot's hesitation tells me everything. You should stay with Orfu another, 14 minutes, 39 seconds, I say. The shape the poor guy's in, the world might end, and he wouldn't know it unless you told him. Orfu says that you're pretty funny for a Skolik, Hockenberry, says Monmouth. I still think I should go with you. One, I say, you're using up all our goddamn time talking. Two, I only have one Hades helmet, and I don't want to be caught because the gods see a robot walking with invisible me. Three, goodbye. I pull the Hades helmet cowl down over my head, twist the medallion, and go. I QT right into the great hall of the gods. It looks like they're all here except for Athena and Apollo, whom I suppose are floating in the healing tanks with green worms in their eyes and armpits about now. In the few seconds I have before the baklava hits the fan, I see that the gods are armored and armed for war. The hall is resplendent with gold breastplates, shining spears, tall helmets with feathered plumes, and polished, god-sized shields. I see Zeus standing by his blazing chariot, Poseidon in dark armor, Hermes and Hephaestus armed to the teeth, Ares carrying Apollo's silver bow, Hera in gleaming bronze and gold, and Aphrodite pointing my way. Shit. Skolik, Hockenberry, bellows Zeus himself, looking right at me across the crowded hall. Freeze! It's not just Zeusian advice. Every muscle and tendon and ligament and cell in my body freezes. I feel the cold stop my heart. Brownian motion ceases in me. My hand doesn't make it an inch toward the QT medallion before I'm a statue. Take the Hades helmet, the QT device, and everything else from him, commands Zeus. Ares and Hephaestus spring forward and strip me naked in front of gods and goddesses. The leather helmet is tossed to a glowering Hades and, dressed as he is in black, chitinous armor of exotic design, he looks like a terrible, glowering beetle. Zeus steps forward and grabs up my QT medallion from the floor, staring at it and glowering as if he's going to crush it in his giant fist. The two gods finish ripping my clothes off and don't even leave me my wristwatch or underpants. Unfreeze, says Zeus. I collapse onto the marble floor and pant, holding my chest. My heart aches so much as it begins beating again that I'm sure I'm having a coronary. It's everything I can do just not to piss myself in front of everyone. Take him away, says Zeus, turning his back on me. The 8-foot-tall Ares, god of war, grabs me by the hair and drags me away. 55. The Equatorial Ring.
Thinketh himself,
hissed Caliban's voice from the shadows of the firmary,
would teach the reasoning couple what must means. Doth as he likes, or wherefore, Lord? So he.
Where the hell's that voice coming from? Snapped Harmon. The firmary was mostly dark, light coming from the glowering tanks that were emptying one by one, and Demon roamed from the semi-permeable wall to the cannibal table, trying to find the source of the whispers. I don't know, said Demon at last. Air vent, some entrance we haven't found, but if he comes into the light, I'll kill him. You may shoot him, said the Prospero hologram, standing against the counter near the healing tank controls. But it is not certain that you will kill him. Caliban, a devil, a born devil, on whose nature nurture can never stick, on whom my pains humanely taken, all lost, quite lost. For 2 days and nights, 47.5 hours, 144 revolutions of the asteroid from Earthlight to Starlight, the two men had overseen the faxing out of the healing tanks until only a dozen or so bodies were left. They knew now how to call up external holos of the linear accelerator, accelerating in a most linear fashion, directly toward them. They could see the huge thing now, approaching wormhole first, visible and awful in the clear overhead firmary panels, thrusters burning blue behind.
Prospero and the virtual readouts assured them that they had almost 90 minutes left before impact, but instinct and their vision told them otherwise, so both men quit looking up. Caliban was somewhere near. Damon kept his thermskin mask down for the light-augmenting lenses, but also used Savi's flashlight, playing it under the cannibal table, light glinting on white bones there. They thought the trip from the domed control room was the worst. The long swim kick through kelp and half-light, waiting for Caliban to attack at any minute. But although twice something green-gray moved in the shadows, and twice Demon had fired Savi's gun at the movement, once the shadow thing swam away, and the next time it tumbled out dead, flechettes glinting in its gray flesh. A post-human corpse in the kelp. But now, after 47.5 hours more without sleep and eating only rancid lizard flesh, there was no worst. This last hour was the worst. At least they'd stopped by the entrance to the grotto, pounded the ice skim with their boots and gun butt until they could refill their single bottle with spheroids of vile, scummed, much-lusted after water. At least they'd done that. But now the water was gone and neither man could leave his post and leave the firmary to go for more. Besides, they'd taken plastic sheets from the tops of the tanks and nailed them up over the semi-permeable entrance membrane so that they'd be warned by the ripping if and when Caliban entered the firmary that way. So they couldn't easily go out that way if they wanted. Now both men's tongues were swollen and their heads ached abominably from thirst and fatigue and the bad air and fear. They'd had little problem with the dozen firmary servitors. Several were allowed to continue to work at their tasks of faxing out the healed bodies, while others, whose duties got in the men's way, were incapacitated. Demon had fired the gun at one, but that was a mistake. The flechettes tore paint and metal fragments from the servitor and shattered one manipulator arm and ripped off an eye, but did not destroy it. Harmon solved the problem by finding a heavy piece of pipe in the tank farm, wrenching it free, allowing liquid oxygen to steam into the already cold air, and bashing the servitor into immobility. The remaining servitors went into retirement the same way. Prospero arrived when they powered up the holographic comm sphere atop the control panel, and the Magus made sure their adjustments were correct on the tank voidings. First they shut off the incoming fax nodes. Then they immediately faxed the arriving 20-somethings back to their earthly nodes before any repair was started. Prospero said that there was no way to hurry the work of the blue worms and the orange fluid, so they left those tanks to cycle. The humans floating naked who were near the end of their healing were faxed back early. Of the 669 tanks in the firmary, all but 38 were empty now. 36 of those were extensive repairs, and two were regular 20s who had faxed in and begun normal repair just before Harmon and Demon had managed to shut off the fax computers.
"Also, it pleaseth Cenobos to work," hissed the unseen Caliban's voice.
"Shut up," shouted Demon. He moved between the glowing tanks, trying not to float in the low but appreciable gravity there. Shadows danced everywhere, but none of them were solid enough to shoot.
"Falls to make something piled yon pile of turfs, and squared and stuck there squares of soft white chalk," whispered Caliban from the dark. "And with a fish tooth, scratched a moon on each, and set up endwise certain spikes of tree, and crowned the whole with a sloth skull atop, found dead i' the woods, too hard for one to kill, no use at all in the work. For work's soul's sake, shall some day knock it down again. So he..."
Harmon laughed. "What?" Demon walked and floated back to the virtual controls where the holosphere allowed Prospero to stand. Parts and pieces of servitors were everywhere underfoot, mimicking the cannibal table farther back in the shadows. "We have to get out of here soon," said Harmon, rubbing his reddened eyes. "The monster is beginning to make sense to me." "Prospero," said Demon, moving his eyes from shadow to shadow in the shadowy forest of softly glowing tanks, "who or what is this Cenobos that Caliban keeps going on about?"
"Caliban's mother's god," said the Magus.
And you said that Caliban's mother is out there somewhere as well?
Damon held the gun in one hand and rubbed his eyes with the other. The infirmary was all blurry, and only partially because of the drifting steam from the spilled liquid oxygen.
Yes, Sycorax still lives, said Prospero, but not on this isle. No longer on this isle.
And this Cerebas? Prompted Damon.
The enemy of the quiet, said Prospero.
Like both his congregation of two, a bitter heart that bides its time and bites.
Buzzers went off above the console. Harmon activated virtual controls. Three more healed humans, almost healed at least, were faxed away. 35 remained.
Where'd this Cerebas come from? Asked Harmon.
Brought in from the dark with the Voynix and other things, said Prospero. A minor miscalculation.
Is Odysseus one of those other things brought in from the dark? Asked Demon.
Prospero laughed. Oh, no. That poor fellow was sent here by a curse from that crossroads where most of the post-humans have fled. No longer by a wicked, wicked lady whom I know as Ceres, but whom Odysseus knew in every sense as Circe.
I don't understand, said Harmon. Savi said she discovered Odysseus only a short time ago, sleeping in one of her cryo-couches.
That was true, said Prospero, but a lie as well. Savi knew of Odysseus' voyage and where he seeks to go. She used him as surely as he used her.
But he is the Achaean from the Turin drama? Asked Demon.
Yes and no, said Prospero in his maddening way. The drama shows a time and tale that's cleft. Miss Odysseus is from one of those branchings, yes. He's not the Odysseus of all the telling, no.
You still haven't told us who Cerebas is, said Harmon. His temper was short. Six more humans faxed out of their tanks, finished and healed. Only 29 remained. It was 20 minutes until the time they'd set to make a run for the Sony. The linear accelerator was close enough to see out the window now with no amplification. The wormhole was a sphere of shifting light and dark.
Cerebas is a god whose hallmark is pure, arbitrary power, said Prospero. He kills at random, he spares at a whim. He murders vast numbers, but with no pattern or plan. He's a September 11 god, an Auschwitz god.
What? Said Demon.
It doesn't matter, said the Magus.
Seth, hissed Caliban from the darkness down by the cannibal table.
He may like, perchance, what profits him.
Aye, himself loves what does him good, but why? Gets no good otherwise.
God damn it, roared Demon. I'm going to find that bastard.
He took the gun and bounced down toward the darkness. Five more human bodies faxed away and their tanks emptied with a whoosh. 24 remaining.
There were bodies on the floor here, bodies on the table, parts of bodies on the chair. Demon held Savi's flashlight in his left hand, her gun in his right, his cowl and night lenses in place, but still the darkness threw shadows. He watched and waited for movement out of the corner of his eyes.
Demon, called Harmon.
In a minute, shouted Demon, waiting, using himself as bait. He wanted Caliban to leap.
There were 5 flechette rounds in the gun right now. And he knew from experience that they would fire rapidly if he held the trigger down. He could put 5,000 crystal darts into the murdering son of a bitch if...
Demon!
He turned back to Harmon's shout.
Do you see Caliban? He shouted back at the lighted control area. No, said Harmon, something worse.
Demon heard the pressure valves roaring and the soft alarms, then something was wrong with the tanks. Harmon pointed to various virtual readouts flashing red.
The tanks are draining before the last bodies are healed.
Caliban found a way to interrupt the nutrient flow from outside the infirmary somewhere, said Prospero. These 24 men and women are dead.
Damn, roared Harmon. He pounded his fist against the wall.
Damon walked into the tank forest, shining the flashlight into the draining tanks.
The fluid level's dropping fast, he called to Harmon.
We'll fax them out anyway.
You'll be faxing corpses home with blue worms boiling in their guts, said Demon. We have to get out of here.
That's what Caliban wants, shouted Harmon.
Demon couldn't see the control console now. He was deep in the rearmost row of tanks in the dark places where he had been afraid to go before.
The gun was heavy in his hand. He continued to shine the light from tank to tank. Prospero was droning on in his old man's voice.
You do look, my son, in a moved sort, as if you were dismayed. Be cheerful, sir. Our revels now are ended. These, our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial, faded, leave not a rack behind. And we are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a...
Shut the fuck up, shouted Demon. Armin, can you hear me? Yes, said the older man, slumped over the control panel. We have to go, Demon. We lost these last 24. There's nothing we can do. Armin, listen to me. Demon was standing in the back row of the tank's flashlight beam steady. In this tank... Demon, we have to go. The power's dying. Caliban is cutting the power. As if to prove Harmon's point, the holosphere faded and Prospero winked out of existence. The tank lights went off. The glow of the virtual control panel began fading away. Harmon! Shouted Demon from the shadows. In this tank! It's Hannah! 56. The Plains of Ilium. I have to go find Achilles and Hector, Monmouth said to Orpho. I'm going to have to leave you here on Thicket Ridge.
Sure, why not? Maybe the gods will mistake me for a gray boulder and not drop a bomb on me. But will you do me two favors?
Of course.
First, keep in tight beam touch. It gets sort of lonely here in the dark when I don't know what's going on, especially with only a few minutes left before the device goes off.
Sure.
Second, tie me down, will you? I like this levitation harness stuff, although I'm damned if I can figure out how it works. But I don't want the breeze to blow me into the sea again.
Already done, said Monmouth. I've got you tied to the biggest rock on the leaping Amazon Marina's mounded tomb up here on the ridge.
Great, said Orpheus. By the by, do you have any idea who this leaping Amazon Marina was, and why she has a tomb here just outside the walls of Ilium?
Not a clue, said Monmouth. He left his friend behind and began running on all fours across the plains of Ilium toward the Achaean camp, receiving a few curious stares from the milling Greeks in the process. They didn't have to search the beach for Achilles and Hector. The two heroes had just crossed the trench bridge and were leading their captains and 2,000 or 3,000 fighters with them toward the middle of the old battlefield. Monmouth decided to be formal and rose to his hind legs for the greetings.
Little machine, said Achilles, where is your master?
The son of Dwayne. It took Monmouth a second to process this. Hockenberry, he said at last, first of all, he's not my master. No man is my master, and I'm no man. Secondly, he's gone to Olympus to see what the gods are up to. He said he'd be right back. Achilles showed his white teeth in a grin. Good. We need intelligence on the enemy. Odysseus, standing between Hector and Achilles, said, It didn't work too well for Dolon. Diomedes, behind the heroes, laughed. Hector scowled. Dolon was Hector's scout last night when things looked so bad for the Greeks, said Orpheus. Even though Monmouth understood Greek now and could speak it after the download from Orpheus, he was still sending the whole dialogue to his friend via subvocals. Orpheus' message wasn't finished. Diomedes and Odysseus captured Dolon when they were going out on a night raid, and after promising the Trojan that they wouldn't hurt him, they got all the information they could from him, and then Diomedes cut off his head. I think that Diomedes mentioned it because he still doesn't really trust Hector as an ally, and... Shelve it, said Monmouth, forgetting to subvocalize. He switched frequencies. I need to concentrate here. Monmouth thought he was capable of multitasking as well as any other Moravec, but Orpheus's history lesson was interfering with his real-time concentration. What did you just say? Demanded Hector. The Trojan hero was not happy. Monmouth remembered that the man's mother and half-sister had just been killed in the aerial bombardment, although he wasn't sure that Hector knew that yet. Perhaps Hector was just in a bad mood. Just a brief prayer to my own gods, said Monmouth. Odysseus had dropped to one knee and was feeling Monmouth's arms, torso, head, and protective shell.
Ingenious, said the son of Laertes. Whichever god crafted you, it was a fine job. Thank you, said Monmouth. I think you've stepped into a Samuel Beckett play, sent Orfu. Shut up, Monmouth said, and sent in English. Damn it, I keep forgetting to set the tight beam for sub-vocal only. He prays still, said Odysseus, getting to his feet. But I like the part where he said that his name was No Man. I'll remember that. Fleet-footed Achilles, said Monmouth in the proper Greek. May I ask your intentions now? We go to challenge the gods to come down for single combat, said Achilles. Or their army of immortals against our army of men, whichever they prefer. Monmouth looked at the few thousand Greeks, many of them bloodied, who'd followed Achilles out from the camp. He turned his head and saw a thousand or fewer Trojans coming over the ridge to join Hector. This is your army? Asked Monmouth. The others will join us, said Achilles. Little machine, if you see Hockenberry, son of Dwayne, tell him to come to me at the center of the field. Achilles, Hector, and the Achaean captains strode off. The Moravec had to dodge quickly or be trampled by the men in shields following. Wait! Called Monmouth. He'd used more amplification than he'd planned. Achilles, Hector, Odysseus, Diomedes, Nestor, and the others turned. The men between Monmouth and the heroes made a space. In 30 seconds, said Monmouth, something's going to happen. What? Demanded Hector. I don't know, thought Monmouth. I don't even know if we'll feel the effects here. Hell, I don't even know if my timer trigger is going to work at that depth in the caldera lake. You're sub-vocalizing, you know, said Orfu. Sorry, said Monmouth. Aloud, he said in Greek, wait and see. 18 seconds now. The Greeks didn't use minutes and seconds, of course, but Monmouth thought he'd got the unit's translation right. Even if the device blows Mars to bits, said Orfu, I don't think this Earth is in that time or universe. But then again, the so-called gods have connected this place, wherever it is, to Olympus Mons via 1,000 quantum tunnels. 9 seconds, said Monmouth. What would an exploding Mars look like in daylight from this point in Asia Minor, said Orfu? I could do a quick simulation. 4 seconds, said Monmouth. Or I could just wait to see. Of course, you'll have to see for me. 1 second, said Monmouth. 57, Olympus. I don't remember Ares or Hephaestus QTing as they dragged me out of the Great Hall, but obviously they did. The room they'd thrown me into, my holding cell, is on the upper floor of an impossibly tall building on the east side of Olympus. The door was sealed behind them, and there are no windows as such. But another door opens onto a balcony that hangs hundreds of feet above nothing except the slopes of Olympus, right where they drop down to the vertical cliffs of Olympus. To the north is the ocean, a burnished bronze in this afternoon light, and far, far to the east are the three volcanoes I realize now are Martian volcanoes. Mars. All these years, Mother of Mercy, Mars. I shiver in the cold air. I see the goosebumps on my naked arms and thighs and can imagine them on my bare butt. The soles of my feet are ice cold against the chilly marble. My scalp hurts from being dragged and my pride hurts from being caught and stripped naked so easily. Who did I think I was? I've been watching gods and superheroes so long that I forgot I was just an ordinary guy when I was real. Less now. The toys went to my head, I think. The levitation harness and impact armor and morphing bracelet and QT medallion and shotgun mic and zoom lenses and taser baton and Hades helmet. All that nifty, sharper image crap. It allowed me to play superhero for a few days. No longer. Daddy took my toys away and Daddy's angry. I remember Monmouth's bomb and out of old habit, lift my bare wrist to check the time. Shit, I don't even have my watch. But it has to be only a few minutes until the robot's device is supposed to detonate. I lean out from the balcony, but this side of the building looks away from the caldera lake, so I guess I won't see the flash. Will the shock wave knock this building off the top of Olympus, or merely set it afire? A new memory swims up. TV images of doomed men and women jumping from burning towers in New York. And I close my eyes and squeeze my temples in a vain attempt to get rid of these unbidden visions. It only makes them more vivid. Hell, I think, if they'd let me live another few weeks, if I'd let me live just by not screwing around with my toys and the fates of so many, I might have remembered all of my previous life, maybe even my death. The door crashes open behind me and Zeus strides in alone. I turn to face him, walking back into the bare room. Do you want a recipe for losing all self-esteem? Try being naked and barefoot, facing the god of all gods who's dressed in high boots, golden greaves, and full battle armor. Besides that obvious disparity, there's the height thing. I mean, I'm 5'9" tall, not short, I used to remind people, including my wife Susan, but average height. And Zeus has to be 15 feet tall this afternoon. The damned door was made for NBA stars carrying other NBA stars standing on their shoulders. And Zeus had to duck when he came in. Now he slams the door behind him. I see that he's still carrying my QT medallion in his massive hand. Skolik Hockenberry, he says in English. Do you know what trouble you've caused? I try to make my stare defiant, but I settle on not allowing my bare legs to shake uncontrollably. I can feel my penis and scrotum contracting toward baby carrot and marble size from cold and fear. As if noticing, Zeus looks me up and down. My God, you old-style humans were ugly to look upon, he rumbles. How can you be so scrawny, your ribs are showing, and still have a paunch?
I remember that Susan used to say that I had a butt like two BBs, but she used to say it with affection.
How do you know English? I ask, voice quavering. Shut up! Roars the father of the gods. Zeus brusquely gestures me onto the balcony and follows me out. He's so huge that there's barely room enough for me out here beside him. I back into a corner, trying not to look down. All this angered god of gods has to do now is lift me in one hand and fling me over the railing to get his revenge. I'd be flapping and screaming for 5 minutes on the way down. You harmed my daughter, growls Zeus. Which one? I think desperately. I'm guilty of conspiring to kill Aphrodite and Athena, although I suspect it's Athena he's talking about. He's always been fond of Athena. I suspect it doesn't matter. Conspiring to harm any god, much less to overthrow the gods in general, has to be a capital offense. I peer over the railing again. I see the crystal escalator snaking down into the mists at sea level directly below. Although my old Skolik barracks, burned to the ground as it is too small to see with regular vision. Good Christ, that's a long way down. Do you know what's going to happen today, Hockenberry? Asks Zeus, although I assume the question is rhetorical. He extends his arms straight down and sets his fingers, each half as long as my forearm, on the stone railing. No, I say. He turns to look down at me. That must be disturbing after all these years of Skolik wisdom, he rumbles. Always knowing what's going to happen next, even when the gods do not. You must have felt like fate himself. I felt like an asshole, I say. Zeus nods. Then he points toward chariots rising off the summit of Olympus one after the other. There are hundreds of them. This afternoon, says Zeus, we are going to destroy mankind. Not just those posturing fools at Troy, but all human beings everywhere. What can you say to that? That seems a bit excessive, I manage at last. My bravado would be more satisfying if my voice weren't still shaking like a nervous boy's. Zeus looks out at the rising chariots and at the mass of golden armored gods and goddesses still waiting to mount their cars. Poseidon and Ares and others have been after me for centuries to eliminate humankind like the virus it is, says Zeus, rumbling more to himself than to me, I think. We all have concerns. This age of man heroic, you see at Ilium, would concern any race of gods. Too much inbreeding between their race and ours. You must know the amount of DNA nano-engineering that we've passed down to freaks like Heracles and Achilles through our libidinous fucking with mortals. And I mean that literally. Why are you talking to me about this, I ask. Zeus really looks down at me now. He shrugs those huge shoulders 8 feet above my head. Because you're going to be dead in a few seconds, so I can talk freely.
On Olympus, Skolik Hockenberry, there are no permanent friends or trustworthy allies or loyal mates. Only permanent interests. My interest is in remaining lord of the gods and ruler of the universe. It must be a full-time job, I say sarcastically. It is, says Zeus. It is. Just ask Cetabas or Prospero or the Quiet if you doubt me. Now, do you have any last questions before you go, Hockenberry? I do, actually, I say. To my amazement, the quaver is gone from my voice, the quiver gone from my knees. I want to know who you gods really are. Where are you from? I know you're not the real Greek gods. We're not, says Zeus. His smile, sharp white teeth glinting from his gray-silver beard, is not paternal. Who are you? I ask again. Almighty Zeus sighs. I'm afraid we don't have time for the story right now. Goodbye, Skolik Hockenberry. He takes his hands off the railing and turns toward me. As it turns out, he's right. We don't have time for the story or for anything else. Suddenly, the tall building shakes, cracks, moans. The very air above the summit of Olympus seems to thicken and ripple. Golden chariots stagger in flight, and I can hear the shouts and screams from gods and goddesses on the ground far below. Zeus staggers back against the rail, drops the QT medallion on the marble floor, and reaches out a huge hand to steady himself against the building, even as the tall tower shakes on its foundations, vibrating back and forth in a 10-degree arc. He looks up. Suddenly the sky is full of streaks. I can hear sonic booms as line after line of fire slashes across the Martian sky. Above Olympus, above our heads, several huge spinning spheres of space black and magma red are opening against the blue. They are like holes punched into the sky itself, and they're spinning lower. Lower down, much farther down, I see more of these jagged circles, each one with the radius of a football field at least, spinning at the base of Olympus. More appear out above the ocean to the north, some slicing into the sea itself.
Ants are coming through the land-based circles by the thousands, and then I realize that the ants are men. Human men? The sky is filled now not only with golden chariots, but with sharp-edged black machines, some larger than the chariots, some smaller, all carrying the lethal, inhuman look of military design.
More fiery streaks fill the upper atmosphere, lashing down toward Olympus like ICBMs. Zeus raises both fists toward the sky and bellows at the little god figures far below. Raise the Aegis, he roars. Activate the Aegis. I'd love to stay around and see what he's talking about and what happens next, but I have other priorities. I throw myself headfirst between Zeus's mighty arch of legs, slide on my belly across the bouncing marble floor, grab the QT medallion in one hand, and twist its dial with the other. 58. The Equatorial Ring. At first, they couldn't get Hannah out of the tank. The heavy piece of pipe wouldn't dent the plastic glass. Demon fired off three rounds from Savi's gun, but the flechettes barely nicked the tank's surface before ricocheting around the firmary, smashing fragile things, ripping into already decommissioned servitors, and barely missing both men. Finally, Harmon found a way to clamber to the top of the tank, and they used the pipe as a lever to first lift and then rip off the complicated lid. Then Harmon pulled his thermskin visor lower, tugged on the osmosis mask, and leaped down into the draining fluids to pull Hannah out. With the main power out, lights off, and tank glow fading to nothing, they worked mostly by the light of the single flashlight. Naked, wet, hairless, her skin looking raw and new, their young friend looked as vulnerable as a baby bird as she lay on the wet firmary floor. The good news was that she was breathing, gasping, shallowly, alarmingly, rapidly, but definitely breathing on her own. The bad news was that they couldn't wake her. "Is she going to live?" demanded Demon. The other 23 men and women in the tank were obviously dead or dying, and there was no way to get to them in time. "How do I know?" gasped Harmon. Demon looked around. "Temperature's dropping in here without the power to heat things. Another few minutes it'll be below zero, just like outside in the main city. We have to find something to cover her with." Still carrying the gun, but mostly heedless, not looking for Caliban, Demon ran through the darkening firmary. There were human bones, haunches of decaying flesh, motionless servitors, bits and pieces of beakers and tubes and pipes, but not so much as a blanket. Demon ripped a square sheet of clear plastic from the covering they'd already torn to seal the semi-permeable entrance and returned. Anna was still unconscious, but shivering uncontrollably. Harmon had his arms around her and was rubbing her flesh with his bare hands, but it didn't seem to be helping. The plastic folded awkwardly around her thin white body, but neither man thought it was holding in any body heat. "She's going to die unless we do something," whispered Demon. From the shadows of the now dark healing tanks there came a sliding sound. Demon didn't even bother to raise his gun. Steam from the liquid oxygen and other spilled fluids was filling the infirmary. "We're all going to die soon anyway," said Harmon. He pointed toward the clear panels above them. Demon looked up. The white star that was the 2-mile-long linear accelerator was closer, much closer. "How much time left?" he asked. Harmon shook his head. "The chronometers disappeared with the power and Prospero." "We had about 20 minutes to go when the problems began." "Yes," said Harmon. "But how long ago was that? 10 minutes? 15? 19? Damon looked up. The Earth was gone, and only stars, including the bright shape rushing at them, burned cold in the clear panels. "The Earth was still visible when this crap started," he said. "Can't be much more than 20 minutes ago when the Earth reappears." The blue and white limb of the planet moved into sight among the lower panes. "We have to go," said Demon. There were more crashes and slidings in the dark behind them. Demon whirled with the gun high, but Caliban did not emerge. The firmary gravity was failing now as well. Pooled fluids were lifting themselves from the floor and trying to float, accreting themselves into amoeba shapes, seeking to become spheres. Savi's flashlight reflected back from slick surfaces everywhere. "How do we go?" asked Harmon. "Leave her behind?" Anna's eyelids were not quite closed, but they could see only the whites of her eyes. Her shaking was lessening, but this seemed ominous to Demon. Demon had tugged up his mask. There was just enough air in the firmary to breathe, although it still smelled like a meat locker with the power off, and now he rubbed his beard. "We can't get her to the Sony with only 2 thermskins. She'd die of exposure in the city, much less in space." "There's the Sony force field and heater," whispered Harmon. "Savi had them on when we were flying high." He tugged his own mask up again, and his breath fogged in the cold air. There were icicles in his beard and mustache. His eyes looked so tired that it hurt Demon to look at them. Demon shook his head. "Savi told me all about how cold and hot it was in space, what vacuum does to the body. She'd be dead before we got the force field powered up." "Do you remember how to power it up?" asked Harmon. "How to fly the damn thing?" "I don't know," said Demon. "I watched her fly it, but I never thought I'd have to." "Don't you remember how?" "I am so tired," said Harmon, rubbing his temples. Anna had quit shaking and now looked dead. Demon peeled his thermskin glove back and put his bare palm on her chest. For a second he was sure she was gone, but then he felt the faint, bird-rapid beat of her heart. "Harmon," he said, voice strong, "get out of your thermskin." Harmon looked up at him and blinked. "Yes," he said stupidly. "You're right, I've had my 520s. She deserves to live more than..." "No, you idiot," Demon began, helping him tug off his suit. The air was already turning Demon's exposed face and hands to ice. He couldn't imagine being naked in this cold. The air was thinning as they spoke, their voices sounding higher and fainter. "Share the thermskin with her. Count to 500, then peel it off her and warm yourself. Keep swapping unless she dies." "Where are you going to be?" gasped Harmon. He'd tugged the thermskin off and was trying to pull it on the unconscious girl, but his hands and arms were shaking so badly from the cold that Demon had to help him. Immediately, the thermskin adapted itself to Hannah's body, and she began shaking again, although the suit was holding in almost 100% of her body heat now. Harmon set his osmosis mask over her face. "I'm going for the Sony," gasped Demon. He handed Harmon the gun, but had to lift his own osmosis mask to make himself heard, since the other man wasn't on suit comm any longer. "Here, you keep this in case Caliban comes for you too." Demon lifted the 4-foot-long length of pipe they'd used as a crowbar. "He won't," said Harmon between racking breaths. "He'll go for you, and then he can eat us all at his leisure."
Well, I hope we give him a bellyache, said Demon. He pulled down his osmosis mask and kicked and ran and floated toward the exit membrane. It was only after Demon had used the sharp end of the pipe to rip and tear a man-sized hole in the membrane, kicking through into the even lower gravity and deeper cold and dark outside the infirmary, that he realized that he hadn't told Harmon that his plan was to come back with the Sony to somehow get it through the window wall to pick them up. Well, too late to go back to tell him now. Demon had always had trouble keeping up with Savi and Harmon when the three of them were first swim-kicking their way through the Crystal City a month ago. An eternity ago. But now Demon swam through the thin air like some low-gravity sea creature. A Crystal City otter, always finding the perfect place from which to kick off at just the right instant. Paddling through the air with his three free limbs with pure economy of effort. Somersaulting and pirouetting with perfect timing to find the next strut or table, or even the next post-human corpse to kick off from for his next leg of the trip. It still wasn't fast enough. He could feel time winning this race even as he looked up at the panels of the Crystal City, the panels showing their dying glow, bringing an even deeper darkness to the kelp beds and body-strewn terraces where he kicked and swam. But there were no clear panels here through which he could see the onrushing linear accelerator. Will I hear it when it crashes through the crystal roof, or is the air too thin for sound? He shook the question out of his head. He'd know when it arrived. Demon almost passed the crystal tower headed south when he looked up and saw that he was already directly under the hundreds and hundreds of stories of air rising into darkness above him. He landed on the asteroid, held the pipe in both hands, swiveling, using only his thermskin lenses to penetrate the darkness. Humanoid shapes floated out there, some close, but their purposeless tumble suggested they were probably post-corpses, not Caliban. Probably. Demon tucked the pipe under his arms, crouched low, remembered Caliban's long-armed squat, imitated it, and shoved off with all the remaining energy in his legs and arms. He floated upward, but slowly, far too slowly. He felt like he was barely moving by the time he got to the first extruded terrace, some 70 or 80 feet up, and realized how weak he was as he used the terrace railing to push himself upward again, watching the shadows as he rose. There were too many shadows. Caliban could leap at him from any of those darkened terraces, but there was nothing Demon could do about it. He had to stay close to the wall and the terraces to keep pushing off, always moving, floating upward, quickly at first, then with dying speed, until he chose the next terrace, feeling like a frog jumping from one stone and metal lily pad to the next. Suddenly Demon laughed out loud. His thermskin, beneath the dirt and mud and blood and grime, was green. He did look like some awkward, scrawny frog, squatting to push himself off vertically at every tenth railing of every tenth terrace. His laugh echoed hollowly through his compads over his ears and shocked him back into silence except for his tortured breathing and grunts. With a stab of fear, Demon paused and did a somersault even as he floated higher. Have I passed the level where the Sony's parked outside? The distance to the floor below seemed impossible. 1,000 feet of empty air at least. And the Sony was only... How many stories up? His heart pounding with panic, Demon tried to remember the holo image in Prospero's control room cell. 500 feet or so up? 700? Sick with terror at having lost his way, Demon floated out further from the wall and checked the panels of glass. Most glowed that sickly, ever-weakening orange. Some were clear this far up, silver with earthlight. None showed the white mark of the semi-permeable membranes at the first airlock in Prospero's door. Did I see such a window mark on the hollow, or just assume there'd be one visible from the inside? Floating almost to a halt now at the apogee of his last leap, Demon wrenched his osmosis mask loose. He was going to vomit. You don't have time for that, idiot! He tried to breathe in the air up here, but it was too thin, too cold, too rank. Only semi-conscious, Demon pulled the mask back down. Why didn't I bring the flashlight? I thought Harmon might need it to tend to Hannah or to shoot at Caliban, but now I can't make out the fucking windows.
Damon forced himself to slow his breathing and to calm down, before the gravity began pulling him down again toward that dark floor hundreds of feet below. He kicked and paddled his way farther out from the wall, rolling over onto his back like a swimmer looking up at the stars. There, another 50 feet up on this wall, the white square on an opaque window panel. Damon did a pirouette, clasped the pipe between his chin and chest, and used both arms and his gloved hands in a powerful breaststroke. If he couldn't get to that closest terrace now, he'd lose 200 or more feet of altitude, and he didn't think he had the strength to fight his way back up again. He reached the terrace, grabbed the pipe with his left hand, and kicked his way vertical, timing it so perfectly that he slowed to a stop just as he reached the white-marked panel. Panting, his vision dimmed with sweat, Demon extended his right arm. His hand and forearm passed through the membrane as if it were slightly sticky gauze. "Thank you, God," gasped Demon. Caliban hit him then, leaping out of the shadowed recesses under the next terrace up, long arms and longer legs wide and grasping, teeth glinting in earthlight. "No!" grunted Demon, just as the monster struck, wrapping arms and legs and long fingers around the man, teeth snapping for Demon's jugular. The human managed to get his right forearm up to protect his throat, Caliban's teeth ripping through flesh and meeting on bone, while the two forms entangled and thrashing, blood fountaining in low G around them, fell together through the thin air down to the next terrace, crashing into glass and plastic and wood and frozen post-human flesh as they tumbled into darkness there. 59. The Plains of Ilium. Monmouth may have been the first to notice what was happening in the sky, sea, and earth around Ilium, but that was because he was expecting it. He hadn't known what he was expecting, but certainly not what he saw now.
"What do you see?"
asked Orfu on the tight beam.
"Ah," gasped Monmouth.
A rotating sphere some hundreds of meters across had appeared in the sky several thousand feet above Ilium. Then a second one rotated into view just above the battlefield, centered between the city and Thicket Ridge. Monmouth turned quickly and saw a third sphere pop into existence above the Achaean encampments. Then a fourth one suddenly appearing several miles out to sea, immediately in front of the scores of fleeing Achaean ships. A fifth one appeared to the north of the city, a sixth one to the south.
"What do you see?"
demanded Orfu.
Said
Monmouth. All of the spheres showed flashing colors but were suddenly filled with stabbing fractal designs. Then all resolved themselves into multiple images of Olympus Mons, seen from different distances, viewed from different angles, and framed by different perspectives. Now, all showed the Martian volcano and the blue Martian sky. One of the spheres settled into the plains of Ilium ahead, so that the Martian ground in the 100-meter-wide circle extended smoothly from the Trojan soil. End of Side 16.